Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.
8:11 now. Good morning. Well, last night, local nonprofit organizations benefited in two ways. The annual grants were handed out to a number of nonprofit organizations and 18 former Motherlode chairlifts. Now, pieces of art were auctioned off with the money raised going directly to the nonprofits. In the studio with the recap, I have Nikki DeFord. She's the Senior Manager of Charitable Contributions for Vail Resorts. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first off, we've got the grants. Vail Resorts contributing a total $7.4 million to all of its mountain resort communities, $1.7 million of that staying here in Park City. So where does that money come from?
You know, it's a mix of both cash grants that we do, and that comes directly from, you know, the revenue that we make every year, and the in-kind piece, the product piece, which is actually very valuable. So when you think about that, that is all of the lift tickets that, say, the National Ability Center uses to do the all of their programs. So it's a mix of both, and both are critical, and it's a commitment that the company makes every single year to do that in all of our different communities.
Yeah, so how's that broken down in terms of the in-kind? I mean, that's considered how much in terms of value?
You know, we don't actually break it out. Mm-hmm. For us, it's hard for us to do that because there is actually, do you want me to back up? Actually, a lot of cash that goes into that in-kind. For example, when we host the Habitat for Humanity event at the Grand Summit, we pay for all that food and beverage. We pay for the labor. And so there is a cash outlay for us in that, and we haven't broken that down. So it's a tough thing for us to break down what is actually cash and what is actually product or in-kind. It kind of crosses the line.
Okay. So how many envelopes did you to hand out last night?
You know, I think we handed out about 31 envelopes last night. And we, you know, there's 31 great partners. About 18 of those are what we would consider major partners. So ones that we have significant funding going to and programs that we're very focused on that focus on our youth programs or environmental initiatives.
All right. And then how are those 31 chosen?
You know, they go through the grant process. So that took place over the summer. And the senior leadership team for Park City sat down in October and went through all of the different all the different requests and really walked through what do we want to do this year? What kind of impact do we want to make? Now we've done this for a few years. So we can say this program had this impact for local kids. And we felt that that was meaningful. You know, we ask our nonprofits to really track the impact that they're making and what they're seeing that their programs can do, not just the numbers, but the actual impact. So that, for example, the mentoring program that the Park City Community Foundation does with the Women's Fund is something, it's not just we reached this many girls, it's that this many girls, you know, were involved in the program and we saw these kinds of results, that, you know, better grades in school, more, you know, participation in different activities. So that's really what we're looking for when we look at the requests and the partnerships that we want to create.
All right. So they're based on projects then. I mean, is that mm-hmm. what you're
you know,
funding?
Programs. Yeah. And I have said that, you know, and when I first came to town a couple of years ago and sat down with different organizations, it was how can we help you do something that you've never been able to do? What is something that you've had on the shelf that you think would be an amazing idea but have never had funding for? And so out of that spurred the eyeglass program that Nan Worrell does at the People's Health Clinic. It supports the Kimball Arts Program, which we heard about last night, that connects kids to the art. You know, and so the reason we do that is it enables us to be able to really track our impact.
All right. You don't announce the amounts that you give to the 31, mm-hmm. but what can you give us an idea? I mean, are there they range from maybe a couple hundred to several thousand?
You know, we want our cash grants to be substantial and even our in-kind grants. So the grants here in Park City range anywhere from, say, $1,000 to $804,000.
All right. And then when we talk about that $7.4 million, I mean, how many mountain communities are we?
You know, so it's five main mountain communities. So in Colorado, that would be where Vail and Beaver Creek are. That would be one community. Where Breckenridge and Keystone are, that's another. And then out in Tahoe, you know, we look at the money and what we have to spend and really where the programs are that we want to spend that money on.
All right. And then also last night, the 18 Motherlode chairlifts auctioned off. Did you have a final tally on how much that raised?
Yeah. So it's right at $100,000. Wow. It's amazing for a one night fundraiser. That's a silent auction. We were floored that it went for that much. But, you know, it's really a kudos to the nonprofits. We provided the chair and the avenue for them to be able to raise money, but they worked very hard to get their donors to step up and buy those chairs. So it was amazing to see.
Now, there was an additional $1,500 that mm-hmm. went to one of the 18 because they got the most votes.
We wanted a community element to this program that we've been working so hard on. So all week we had the chairs available for people to go and look at the Kimball and ask people to place a vote, you know, what was their favorite chair. So it turns out that the favorite chair was the People's Health Clinic's Chairari, modeled after a Ferrari. And it was also amazing. So, yeah, Nan and her team get an extra $1,500.
All right. And then did any of them sell for their kind of market value?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one of them I know went for about $15,000.
Yeah, well, at NAC, the National Ability Center's chair sold, I think, before it was even taken off the truck on Tuesday for $17,000. And then the Education Foundation's chair went for $15,000 last night. And I got to say, Charlie Sturges worked the crowd and almost got his chair for their Buy Me Now price, but he got $14,100. So, yeah, everyone did an amazing job.
All right. Also new this year is the formation of the Epic Promise Foundation. So until now, the money was just being funneled through Vail Resorts?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a little bit different than that. So we have our community grants. We've done those for years. We're going to continue to do those the way that we have done them. The Epic Promise Foundation is really a commitment to our employees. So all the money that goes into and out of that foundation specifically will go to our employees for both emergency relief and scholarships.
All right. So how we've known it in terms of the grant funding
stays
the same.
Yeah.
And with that foundation, now Vail has committed an annual contribution of $500,000 a year. You also had a personal contribution from Rob Katz, $1.5 million over the next 3 years. So you hope to have be handing out $750,000 each year to employees. Now, an employee, what, applies for a grant for, like, what? I mean, what would they do? I understand, like, maybe if their house burned down or, mm-hmm. you know, they had some medical issues, but what else?
I'd say we have a lot to learn in this category. You know, we're learning as we go here. But, so we're calling it emergency relief, financial hardship. So, and that can be everything from you have a medical crisis and you can't quite make the bills to your heater and your refrigerator go out in the same week and you can't afford to replace both. And so what are you going to do? We can help and step in that situation and help make, you know, we're calling it kind of the bridge the gap money for our employees to help them through what could be very hard or, you know, very stressful situation.
So are these going to be handed out monthly then?
Yeah, we're making those decisions every month. Obviously, there may be instances where we have to make decisions more quickly than that, and we're going to have to be flexible and learn kind of how that works. But, you know, the ultimate goal is to make sure our employees, that we're lessening their suffering a little bit through the emergency relief program. The other piece of it, of course, is the education piece, which goes hand in hand with our commitment to kids and education that we do through our community grants. So for the scholarships, you know, we've done scholarships for our employee dependents for years, but now we're changing that program a little bit and adding employees to the mix. So if you're an employee, yeah, you'll be able to apply for a scholarship to get your GED, to get, you know, take an ESL class, go get your vocational, you know, go to a vocational school or get your 4-year degree. So that's an add-on we haven't ever done before. And then we'll continue the employee dependent scholarships as well.
Yeah. So employees can apply, what, through their HR departments? Or
yeah. So we'll have a whole application system that will be on epicpromise.com. And it'll be very clear. You know, we'll have separate applications for scholarships and emergency relief. You know, we're going to have separate employee committees determining those scholarships. It's really for employees, by employees, all the way around here.
Okay. Anything else, Nikki?
No, thank you.
All right. Thanks for coming in. Nikki DeFord, 8:32 now. Good morning. Well, it was a long agenda item last night with regard to the discussion of a new ice sheet in the studio with me to talk about that. And some of the other issues discussed last night, I have Park City Mayor Jack Thomas along with translator Salima Espinoza. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start, Jack, first with the ice rink. You had a consultant and architect, Craig Elliott, presenting a couple of options, some various twists on each of those options. Basically, we're talking about a community sheet that could be a second ice sheet next to the existing one, perhaps a second sheet that is on the adjacent property or an entirely new facility. that could be expandable if an Olympic Games were ever to happen again, Park City. So any reaction from the council about where we go from here?
Well, I think the council is interested in what percentage of the Park City community has used the existing ice sheet and facilities. And as we understand it, it's about 16%. And so that's a consideration moving forward, you know, with regard to funding any kind of a facility at that location. You know, we want to know who our partners are and are they coming to the table to help participate in an idea like this. But, you know, I said last night that I probably have about a 16% interest in moving forward with this. And I think the council all had some consideration about that that involvement with the community, given that they're talking about something that could cost $20 million.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that would be my question. Why are we even doing this? I mean, you've got critical priorities that, you know, need attention to, and recreation isn't on the top of those.
Right. Well, there's a recreation master plan that we're looking for, and that will come next. But I think the enthusiasm for the ice is probably relative to the percentage of use. And so that's a consideration for the council as well.
So the majority of the users then are coming from what zip code?
I think they're coming from the county, Wasatch County, Summit County. And I don't have those percentages immediately in front of me, but you know, the 84% is outside of Park City proper.
All right. And so maybe even a new location. I mean, maybe it doesn't make sense to even have the location here because it just means more traffic into, you know, on 248.
Well, they're talking about the Quinns Junction area, so that is kind of on the outskirts of the community, and I don't know that that's a terrible location in terms of traffic and access for county use, but, you know, it's just, you know, there are more people to come to the table regarding this issue.
Yeah, and when you talk about a future Olympic Games, do we even have room there at the Quinns Junction facility to build some kind of Olympic ice rink?
Well, we have seen another Olympics happen in this community. We know that that's a process, and establishing the location of those venues is a process, not just of this city, but the entire community. So, there is an interest for some people to have the ability to expand into an Olympic venue or the planning in place to do something, but I don't think there's any interest in building that now.
So what do you do? I mean, do you have some kind of study session here and bring together the partners?
Well, I think so. I think we're waiting to see the recreation master plan completed, and I think there's a broader discussion.
Yeah. When does that come back, the master plan?
I'm sorry. I think it's later in the spring.
All right. You also heard, had a water conservation update from Jason Christensen with the Water Department. So how are we doing?
I think we're doing a lot better, but I think to the extent that people can get online and watch what their water use is, it could be more powerful because, you know, anybody that goes on the WaterSmart software can see what they're doing. And every time they look at it, just the curiosity of it reduces the water use. So, and it also helps protect against leaks and things like that. So I think it's going better. You know, we've transferred some of the watering of the fields to what we call raw water, so we're not using treated water for watering the soccer fields and things like that, and that's a positive step.
Yeah, so I think you heard only about 30% of residents are using this WaterSmart technology.
Right, but I think that's something that we'd like to see grow. We'd also like to see the commercial users examine this too, because we know that there's tremendous usage in the commercial world.
Yeah, and the deal with conservation, and we certainly saw this happen with Mountain Regional, the more people conserve, the less water you're selling, and that means that rates have to go up to meet the budget. So there's kind of like, you know, a catch-22 here.
Well, there is, but I think you've heard the council say how important, you know, energy conservation and resource conservation is in this community. So
conservation, don't do it for any money savings because you're
we're not trying to just save money. We're trying to go beyond that.
All right. You also had heard from Jason talking about the number of leaks that we have in our water lines. I mean, some 130 miles, I guess, of old lines.
Right. Well, I think there's 100 and I can't remember the exact number either. But, you know, that distribution system, we're looking at putting monitors on that so we can sense leaks in that system. I mean, we know where there's leaks beyond the meter to the house, and that's easy to determine. But examining the distribution system, there's always leaks. There's leaks in power lines. There's leaks in water lines, gas lines. And so we just need to be more efficient with that and get a better sense of where we have lines that need repair.
Yeah, but basically Jason was saying, I mean, to upgrade those lines, I mean, it would be so cost prohibitive. It's maybe just cheaper to let it leak, huh?
No, I think what he's saying is monitoring the lines so that we know where the leaks are. But to replace the infrastructure would be a staggering number.
All right. So at the end of the meeting, a study session was held on Latino issues. Any idea why you saved that for the end? Usually the study sessions are held up front.
Well, that's true. But I think what we wanted to do is have it at an hour where people could actually attend. And, you know, this is an outgrowth of a number of discussions that have been happening in the community. And these discussions are have come about because of, as I said, a lot of nonprofits, the school board, all of the entities that have been dealing with Latino issues in this community. And more importantly, I think the community itself, that 25% of our population is Latino, and they've come forth with some issues and concerns that they've had for a long time. And so Zulema was a translator last night, and we had our first meeting in Spanish and English back and forth, and it was a powerful experience. And so they were very organized, brought forth five ideas and things that they are concerned about, and they had some short-term, some mid-term, and long-term goals that they wanted to discuss with the city council and see if they could enroll some enthusiasm for it.
All right. Well, let's, Salima, let's bring you into the conversation. I mean, how many Hispanic folks showed up to participate in this?
Oh, well, there was a large number of Hispanic families. They brought their kids, and it was amazing to see how many people were there.
Yeah. Who is the Latino leadership? I mean, are there identified leaders that are?
We don't have like one leader, you know, but there's just a group of all kinds of people, you know, parents, kids, school district people also helping us to understand what, you know, the needs are out there and address those issues.
Yeah, I mean, and I look back, you know, 20 years ago, and we had organizations like Conexión Amigo. We used to also used to have Shelley Weiss-Weber, you know, who used to work as a liaison between municipality and Hispanic. I mean, we no longer have that. So, I mean, it sounds like we're, you know, I mean, we don't have that leadership like we used to. I mean, are people ready to step up?
Well, I can't answer right now that question, like giving names, right? But we think it's a very, very important step that we had last night, you know, to step up and say these are our needs as Hispanic, as a Hispanic community living here in Park City. So it's a very, very, you know, important step for us, and we're getting there.
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about what are the five different needs that you identified.
Well, I can help you a little bit with that. I think that there's a tremendous interest in housing. Okay, finding affordable housing in this community, and of course that's a primary goal for the city council, and it was reiterated from this group. You know, it's a struggle to work in the community and in the resort industry, the hotel industry, the service industry, and work in this community. And this community couldn't survive without that participation. And yet, it's almost impossible to live here. So, affordable housing is a huge component of it. I think there's a tremendous interest in daycare facilities. You know, a lot of these folks are working multiple jobs, and it's important to have daycare activities and support in that area. I think there's an interest in emphasizing equal pay for some of these jobs. I mean, it's an issue of equity. You know, there's such a tremendous gap in income that it's, you know, it's hard to, again, make things work. And so I think there's also a tremendous interest in increasing the language skills, both of the children and the parents. And I think we're on our way to some of that with the library hiring a new librarian that speaks Spanish that can help English classes, and the school reaching out and teaching more English classes. I mean, there are works, things that are happening and working in this community that will make that better. I talked about daycare.
Yeah. Well, let's just talk really briefly about some of those, because, I mean, with the affordable housing, again, that's a community-wide effort. With the daycare, I know that we're working with PC Tots. I mean, that's right. They got a big grant, and that's underway. I mean, so something like that's being developed. You know, the increasing the language skills, I mean, we offer free ESL classes. I mean, if I wanted to take a Spanish class, I'd have to pay $100. So, I mean, there's plenty of those.
There are a lot of things like that.
Let's talk about the equal pay issue.
Well, there's one other issue I wanted to bring up before you do that, and that is there are a lot of organizations within the community that help in a lot of different ways, but there's no focal point for resourcing that. So there's no network for connecting that. And I think that that's what you were speaking of when you were talking about that person that helped with that. And I think that's an important need. And perhaps a place, perhaps a center for some of that to happen so that they can get information, they can find out what their rights are, they can get some legal expertise, they can know where to go for some of these other agencies that are participating.
So is that a city role, or should we look to the state?
It's a very good question. I think the city stepped up last night. All of the council said that they supported these goals and have an interest in and bringing this to work session and raising these issues and trying to make a difference here.
And then in terms of this equal pay, though, I can see that happening. Again, if your language skills aren't great, you know, you would have a hard time communicating that. I mean, what are we talking about? You know, people working in a kitchen maybe? White person getting, you know, $10 an hour, and the Hispanic person getting minimum wage? Is that what's happening?
Well, I can't speak to exactly what's happening, but I think we all know that goes on. And I think that the barriers are language, of course, and perhaps racial and perhaps social. And so it's important to kind of attack all these issues and try to transform this. And it's as I said last night, this is the beginning of a long journey to try to make a difference here.
All right. And Salima, I would encourage you to come back on KPCW and speak to the Hispanic community. We, of course, have that Cata Domingo program Sunday nights, 7 to 10 p.m., and do interviews then. And that might be a great venue for you and whoever else.
Some others, I think, as well.
Oh, yes. That would be great. And I'll be here.
Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Jack, anything else from last night's meeting?
I think that's it. I mean, we're moving on. We have a great snow year going on. Love looking out the window and struggling through the snow. It's a great beginning.
Okay.
So thanks, Leslie.
Jack Thomas, Mayor of Park City, and Salima Espinoza, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, Midway writer Dean Hughes, the author of many books focusing on the World War II era, including his most recent book, Home and Away. Dean Hughes joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Thank you.
So this is your 101st book, I guess. So you like to write.
Well, I keep losing count. I think it's actually my 102nd.
Wow. So you like to write. Is that your full-time occupation?
Yeah, it's like anything else. I like to write, but it's like going to work, too. Of course, I like to write, but it's not the easiest life in the world.
Right. Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, many of your books focus on World War II. Any particular reason?
Well, out of 102 books, I think maybe 10 of them do. So, I was born during World War II. I was born in 1943, and I think I've spent a lot of time in my life trying to grasp that time. I don't remember the war itself, but I remember those years right after. And so you kind of go back to your roots. You go back to who, where you came from. I grew up in Ogden, and I think that's fascinated me to understand that time.
All right. So the new book, Home and Away, actually takes a bit closer to home here. It's set in Ogden, rather than overseas. So tell me about that.
It's set both. That's where the home and away come. Part of it is set in the Battle of the Bulge with a boy from Ogden at the war, and then the rest is at home with his family. The Battle of the Bulge was fought in December, and on Christmas Day, a lot of the troops were surrounded in the middle of the battle in Bastogne in Belgium. And I always, as I read about that, I wondered how it would be for the parents back home to, on Christmas Day, know that your son is trapped and maybe overrun. You wonder if he's going to live through the day, through the next day, that sort of thing. And so that's the kind of setting for the whole story.
Hmm. Well, my understanding is that the book is a little bit more personal than others that you have written. How so?
Well, I had an experience, not in the 40s, but in the 50s when I was a teenager. I bought a dress for my mom for Christmas, and my dad gave me some money and asked me to go buy it. And when I got to the store, I went to JCPenney's in Ogden. That's all I could afford. I didn't have quite enough money for the dress I picked out. And then I did. The clerk changed her mind. He said, oh, no, you can get it for that price. And I wondered, did she pay for part of it, or did she get permission to lower the price because she knew how much I wanted it for my mom, or what? And so I've tried to imagine the rest of that story. So in this situation, and I set it back in World War II, when the family's going through so much, I have this boy go and buy a dress for his mother that comes to mean a great deal between them because she loves it so much.
So it sounds like you've done lots of research then to do these books. Huh? So you've got maybe a fascination with history.
Yeah, I've done a lot of historical novels about other periods too. I've written a lot of children's books and a lot of young adult novels, and I've used Mormon history, and I've used you know, various periods of time that I've written about. And yeah, I do love to do the research. In fact, the research is the fun part.
All right. So you've got a couple of book signings. No, not here locally?
No, I have one at the Fort Union Bookstore in Salt Lake this Saturday, tomorrow. And then I have one in Orem at the University, Deseret Book at the University Mall there on a week from Saturday.
Okay, both at 11 a.m., so you'll
yes.
be there with
mm-hmm.
books and
mm-hmm.
signing then?
Yes.
Okay. What are you working on now?
Well, I have just completed a book with my New York publisher that's about the Japanese Americans who fought in World War II for the United States. And many of them were interned in the internment camps. My characters come out of the Topaz camp down in Delta, and they are interned for being Japanese and nothing else. That interned is a nice word for imprisoned. And yet they went and fought for the United States to prove their loyalty. And so I tell that story of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. The Hawaiians who were in the group, Japanese Hawaiians, called it the 442. And that's the name of the book, 442.
All right. And you expect that to come out when?
Probably not until almost fall next year, maybe August or September. Publishers put things in line, and it takes a while to get them out.
Well, it sounds like Home and Away has a nice Christmas message, and I guess good timing on that one.
Yeah,
huh?
That one, yeah. But then I finished it last year, so there's always a time lag there between when you finish a book and it comes out.
Okay. Dean, anything else you want to tell us about the book?
Well, I just think it's a moving story, and you know, I think families go through difficult times, and certainly when your son or daughter go off to war, there are few things that are more stressful to a family, and the feelings people have at Christmas time and that draw you toward home really, really are heartfelt for me, but I think for all of us. And so I think it's a moving story, and I think it gets there are a lot of Christmas stories out there. The Christmas novella has become a kind of genre, and a lot of them are feel to me like straight syrup to drink, you know. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do something that was just sappy. I've tried to deal with some genuine human feelings and some family dynamics that that are worth thinking about and reading about. So I hope it's a book that has a little more profundity in it than just emotion.
Great. Dean, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
It's author Dean Hughes.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.
News time now, 8:54. Good morning. Well, local author Terry Sitford has a new book, 100 Hearts, 100 Surveys, completed by 100 women, stories that honor and celebrate all of them. Terry Sitford joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the book is about what?
It's about the courage of women. So it's based on a survey of 8 questions on the subject of courage, and it was filled out by 100 women. And it's a compilation of the experiences from the answers of the survey and short stories.
All right.
And all the questions and answers are in the book.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So who you had strangers, I mean random, or just friends fill out the survey?
They were friends, and I'm a life coach, so they were clients, and I was not getting enough surveys back. So I asked them to send it to other people. And I started getting it from out of the country, all over the country, from all walks of life. So a lot of strangers as well.
Yeah. So it's not meant to be statistically accurate. It's really just to be, well, you know, just different viewpoints, huh?
Yes. And I think I accomplished that with the variety of women that filled out the survey, with age groups and walks of life. And I did ask about that, but I don't have that in the book.
Yeah. So courage, I mean, that's all 8 questions deal with courage or...
Different things, you know, if you could do something or change something in your life, if you lived your life again, you know, over, would you change something? That's one. What legacy do you want to leave? You know, that would be another one. Have you demonstrated courage in your life? If so, how? So those are type of questions.
All right. And anything that kind of just jumped out at you?
Yes.
Tell me about some of those things that kind of sparked things for you.
After reading the answers from the survey and knowing that these women have been amazingly courageous, most of the women, I'd say 98% of them, and the question, would you change anything in your life if you could live it over again, 98% of them said no. So what that means is that these experiences did make them who they are today, and they wouldn't change that for anything.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the message I want to get out to women. Is that the stories don't have to define you, that stories can help you be stronger and actually lead you to who you really are. And be proud of these stories because they help you find out what you're made of. And be proud of them. And the book, since it's been out, a lot of the responses have been, you know, thank you so much. I don't feel alone. I feel like I have a community. And I really want to tell my story now. And so I'm really proud of that. I want women not to hide their stories. I want them to be proud of their stories.
Yeah. So how did you come up with this idea?
From a personal experience, well, first of all, someone very close to me, I witnessed firsthand the tragedy of her losing her 18-year-old son. And I saw how she handled it with grace and love and didn't change who she was. In fact, I saw her become stronger. She didn't lose that little sparkle in her eye and the love in her heart. And I have the honor of coaching a lot of women. And I've also witnessed women demonstrating courage in their life and standing up for who they are. And that takes courage, opposed to what society and stigmas have tried to make women not be who they are, or women shrinking because of their stories. I've seen women be tremendously courageous in my coaching practice. So that's what inspired me to write the book, because I did notice that women don't see themselves as being courageous. They just do it. They get up and they find the courage needed to do whatever they have to do. And I just want women to understand how incredible they are, that they're not alone, and that they do have a community. And they can really be who they are, regardless of what's happened.
All right, so you have a book signing tomorrow at Dolly's. When's that going to be?
That is from, it's 2 to 4. And I also have one in Midvale next Saturday. And that is from 2 to 5. And that's at Fort Union, Barnes & Noble.
All right. And I noticed that you'd given an acknowledgement to Annette Velarde and Stacey Domalski. How did they help you?
Oh, they were my little angels. They have a lot of experience in writing and self-publishing. I did not set out to write a book, and they've helped me every step of the way. So I really want to encourage anyone that thinks they have a story or they have something they want to tell the world, you can contact these people that can help you through the process, because I never thought I would get this finished. And I just took one step in front of the other, and these two ladies helped me do it.
Great. Well, congratulations. Again, she'll be at Dolly's tomorrow, 2 to 4 p.m. Author Terry Sidford, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.